The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Claff for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
Good evening, and my name is Stan Claff. I'm from the Hebrew Order of David, as you heard, and I'm the Grand Secretary. Tonight we're going to be talking about fundraising and other matters of leadership within Jewish organizations. And I have as a guest Ray Ringel, the CEO of the Ringel Group in Washington, D.C. And she's a very accomplished lady, highly accomplished, in fact, and is in high demand as an innovative coach, facilitator, and trainer across all sectors. She enables companies, nonprofits, government agencies to become more effective managers and stronger communicators with a formidable leadership presence. Good evening, Ray.
Hi.
Hi, and thanks for joining us. I know you have a very busy schedule. It's taken me years to get you on the show. And
happy to be here.
And I have also in the studio Hedley Lewis, he's the CEO of one of the bigger fundraising organizations doing good work in the community called the Smile Foundation. They're busy with the project, and I invited him to come in early, but he's going to talk at the end of the show a little bit about his project, about their project, I should say, but I asked him to join, so I think it might be of interest to him, and maybe he can add a little bit of discussion since he is a prominent fundraiser in the community.
Thanks so much.
And Ray, I've looked at a lot of your tapes. I've read some of your articles. I haven't read any of your books, but I know you're a really prolific book writer. But you made one statement which I find really gets the nub of the matter, and it's an organization's capacity to strive for excellence is integrally linked to its capacity to raise the necessary funds and its ability to ask for them. And that's where I think I came to you in the first place, because you said you have to ask, and how you ask, that's what you're going to tell us.
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, I find that, and it would be curious to see if it's the same in your community, but when I work with organizations and professionals, and especially the volunteers, their feeling is, I will do anything for your organization, anything that you want me to do, except I'm not going to ask for money, right? And there's this fear or paralysis around asking for money. I mean, they will file papers and lick envelopes and go door to door and talk about the organization, but they will not, but they don't want to ask for money. And that's kind of the starting point here, is that all of this magnificent work can't happen without money. So on the one hand, we want to be connected and a part of these organizations and feel good about helping people. But on the other hand, we don't have a large team of people who are really willing to do the work in order to raise the funds. So part of my work is trying to get into the psychology and the inner world of people to help them reframe and understand what the art and craft of fundraising is all about, and how it's something that not only they do all the time, but it's a way to bring people closer to the organization as opposed to pushing them away.
So in South Africa, we have any number of organizations, and they're all digging in the same field, looking for money, and so there's a lot of donor fatigue, and of course those that are better at fundraising seem to attract the bigger share, but I think that everybody has a chance, and I just don't think that all organizations understand how to approach this, and that probably is the reason that volunteers particularly, but even people who are professionals, find it difficult to go out there and ask for money.
Mm-hmm. You're saying because they don't know how, correct?
They don't know how, and that scares them off, because they can't, you know, once they get rejected the first couple of times, it makes it much more difficult to get back in the saddle and try again, and they lose hope, and then generally what happens is they drift away or they go and do something else which is a little bit less challenging.
Yeah. Well, So part of what I do when I hear that is to say, look, we ask people for things all the time. We tell people to spend their money all the time. We tell them to go to great restaurants, vacations, go to movies, all the time we tell people to spend their money when we think they're going to benefit. But then all of a sudden when we want to tell people to spend their money on philanthropic causes, we just shut down. And I think it's because we feel two things. One is we feel like we're asking for ourselves, which we're not. If we're asking for ourselves, that's problematic. We're asking for, the product of the organization. And we get wrapped up in, well, when you're buying a car or a dinner or a meal, there's something tangible. You can touch it and you can feel it. And sometimes when you're giving to an organization, to an annual campaign, it's a bit more amorphous. Like really, you can't touch or feel the product. So it feels harder to ask people for money for that. The onus is on us to make that gift measurable, to show them when you're giving this gift, this is going to be the result of your gift. But we tell people all the time that they should spend their money. And one thing that's really important to note about all this is understanding the principles of consumer psychology. So I always say to my students, if you study consumer psychology, you learn that when people buy anything, when they buy anything in the world, they're actually only buying one thing, and that is good feelings. Anything that you're buying can be traced to feeling good. And it's the same thing for philanthropy. People give to charities and they give staka because they want to feel good. Now, sometimes they just feel good about helping, or it's just linked to their values, or sometimes people give because they want to see their name and on a building and have the status or be a part of an elite social circle. And sometimes people give charity because they want a big tax break at the end of the year. And the truth is, it is not my place to judge their intention. It is just my place to offer them the opportunity to feel good. And if people saw, really understood that they are extending that offer for someone to feel good, I think it might help reframe the process.
So you made a point in one of your talks that I listened to recently, and you made the point that in years gone by, fundraisers were pick of the crop, top people who came into this with pride and were happy to, and were looking forward to being in the job, and actually were looked up to in the fact that they were fundraisers. Yet today, I think you made the point as well that it's not so much. People tend to give those jobs to lesser individuals, people who you think just might go out there and knock on doors and ask, but maybe are not as equipped as they should be.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So it fascinated me because I do remember those days. I'm a little older than Hedley, who's sitting in the studio here. And I do remember those days when people who were fundraisers, they had no shame. They were happy to go in and do it. They did it with pride. And today I think it's in some instances, it's difficult. It's got a bad connotation. And
yeah.
I think that is where it begins and ends, really.
Well, I'll say a couple things about that. Certainly in the U.S., we still talk about fundraising in the language of solicitation. Now, solicitation is also a word for prostitution. Like, it's a crazy thing to call fundraising solicitation. And language is generative. We create with our words. So I myself am on a huge campaign to change the language of fundraising from solicitation to something that feels more appealing. No one is ever wearing a sweatshirt that says I'm a proud Federation solicitor. Like, it just doesn't exist. That's not an identity that we can get around. And the other thing I explain to people is, just to give them a Jewish historical perspective, is when we were set up in Jewish communities in Eastern Europe many, many years ago, and we were set up in shtetls, we had people who were called Gabbai Staka. And these were the collectors of the charity, who would literally go from shtetl to shtetl and collect people's Jewish tax and their donations and put it in the pot, in the community pot, and kind of count up that money and then make the tough decisions around what families, what agencies needed that money. And what was interesting about that model is that to be a Gabbai Staka, you had to work your way up through the community to deserve the honor, the distinction, the privilege. This was like the coveted role to be the person who represents the community. You really were the rock star to be the collector of the charities. And now if you fast forward, you know, many hundreds of years later, now, you know, anyone who shows up and has a pulse is allowed to do this work. We have totally lost the idea of like, I feel so lucky and honored that I can go out and represent the organization in that way. Now people feel like I'm doing the organization a favor for asking for you. And so my big question I sit with is, how do we get back to that spirit and that energy where people feel so honored that they have been like bestowed upon them the position to be able to ask? That's a huge shift.
So do you, when you run campaigns for fundraising, is there like in South Africa here, there's a limit to the amount of administration costs, et cetera, that one can rake off the top, which you can use basically, I suppose, for running the organization, which is essential. And it says so in what you said, you know, its ability to ask for money, and that's how you'll retain the organization or make it work. But in other respects, are people suspicious of that takeoff, or is it an accepted practice?
I think people ask outright. I really do. I often will get the question, what's your overhead? How much money are you spending to do fundraising? And people are pretty transparent about it. I don't think that, that's not something that is like tucked under the carpet. A lot of donors will just straight out ask, how much money are you spending on raising money? And luckily, a lot of at least the Jewish nonprofits are pretty lean. They end up at around somewhere between 8 to 12% is spent on raising the money, which is very, very low compared to if you look at these big, you know, let's say walks for breast cancer or organized events like that, huge fundraisers, that can be up to 40 or 50% of the money goes to actually running that experience. So I don't think it's a secret. I do think people want to know how their money is being spent and what part of their money is not going to the beneficiaries.
Okay. So, just to digress just for a moment, if anybody wants to contact us on WhatsApp, you can contact us on 061-895-1019 or SMS to the SMS line 34519, and we'll take any questions and we'll pose them to our guest. And so Ray, I think that is an issue which comes up often in our kind of fundraising, because Headley runs an organization called the Smile Foundation, which is a very specific charity, an organization working in the community. But the Hebrew Order of David, on the other hand, is where we are more like general practitioners. We do projects for other organizations, and sometimes we do for ourselves, and we distribute the funds amongst the community in food parcels, et cetera, et cetera. So we general jobbers in that way, and each of our lodges around the world will operate in their own way and within their own communities. Whereas, I suppose from a transparent point of view, the Smile Foundation is able to give information about their, in one specific form, because that's what they do. Do you want to chip in?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that we're at different spectrums. I think the HOD is very specific within a specific religious area, and their target market is obviously quite small in terms of South Africa when you've only got 60,000 people. For the Smile Foundation, we're very lucky that we can target anyone in South Africa. My interest and my question really to you is that for us, we have to build business proposals. So we sit with corporates or even high net worths and individuals and say, well, this is what you can get out of it. And Smile's lucky that you've got a child with a cleft palate before and after, and a lot of people will step up. But in today's times, it's really moving to now, what is the impacts? And I also just wanted to know from your side, the big data, because people want to know, well, what are the statistics? How much have you done? How much can you do? And also, around the governance. I mean, I think those are the three business areas that in our world people are moving towards. And just the general ask of putting out your hands are probably my grandfather's years, when you just give a check and say, well, do whatever you need to do.
Yeah. That has really, really changed. I mean, I think you're right. It was more like, this is what you do. This is the right thing to do. Here's the money. I trust you. You're going to do the right thing with it. And now people really want to, you know, they really want to break down how their money's getting spent, how many meals are people being fed. Like, they really want to track and evaluate how their money's being spent. And often they want their name attached to it. You know, much more of a need to have a name on a building or a program, as opposed to, it used to be quite anonymous. People would just give and they didn't want their name in lights. So I think that has shifted, and that puts a strain on the organization to have to be so accountable. And I don't know that that's such a bad thing. I think that we do need to be beholden to our donors, and financially we need to be accountable to them because we're stewarding their money and their gifts. So how's a balance where it's not too much of a strain on the organization, but we're still really being responsible and open and communicative about how we're spending people's money?
So in the Hebrew Order of David, which is our organization, we are volunteers, but more than that, we are paying members. So our operations are funded by the members. So when we do projects, we're net collectors. We, whatever money, less expense of the actual project, we distribute wherever it is. So it's not that we do retain any of that money for operational purposes. So we pretty much target both within the Jewish community and outside of the community, because we do a lot of work for organizations that are outside of the community. We assist in areas like Alexandria, where we'll which is a previously black township, and where there's a poorer element, and we'll do functions there. We run all sorts of things, like we've raised money for the Guide Dogs Association and so on, which are general, but we've tended to back other organizations much more than we've raised money in the name of the Hebrew Order of David. So we've done the project in there, you know, using them as the beneficiary, and pretty much kept nothing for ourselves. That's really, I think it's also a fault, but it's also been a plus for us. So we know that what we've have raised is money that we've then taken off whatever the cost is, you know, the actual cost, and given away the rest. Or we try to give in kind, where we've, people who want something specific, we'll buy it for them.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to just ask you if maybe you can just give some advice to general fundraisers on how to prepare for your targets and your specific meetings. So you could be in the various spectrums, and if, how do you teach your own team on how to prepare? Because as I said, in the old days, you would just go up to someone and say, I really want money, and they'd hand you a check. In today's time, it's M&Es, it's reporting, it's strategy, and probably a lot of the meeting is going to be prepared before. So what would your advice be to a broad range of fundraisers?
Great question. So first is, well, a couple of things. The very first thing you need to do in preparation is to make your own gift. Anyone who is asking someone else for a gift needs to make their own. It doesn't matter what amount. Mostly I say that so that you can credibly use the language, will you join me? We can't ask people to give to something that we haven't given to ourselves. So that's kind of like my first step. The second thing is, what can you find out about that donor? How can you really find out everything possible about that donor, who they are, what they care about, what their work is, where else they give to, whether it's Jewish, non-Jewish, what do they do professionally? Are they from the area? Are they a transplant? Like, you want to just really try and paint a picture so that if you have a sense of who this person is and what they care about, you can already strategically think before you meet them, where should I shine the light in my organization? Like, what part of the organization might resonate for this person based on what I know to be true about them already? The third area I would say is really teach people how to ask great questions. So much of this is about questions and presence and listening and saying to people, not like, okay, so what do you want to give? But asking people, you know, what do they care about?
That's the $1 million question, isn't it?
Exactly. But people make a mistake of doing that first. I always say, right. You know, see the person, not the pocket. Like, try and get really curious about who this person is, what they care about, where their values are, what makes them feel good about giving, what have been positive experiences for them in the past, and what's their possible connection. I mean, fundraising in its most simplistic form is matchmaking. You have to take this person and all that they are and all that they care about and that they're interested in, and then you take your organization and look at it in a very expansive way, and you have to figure out if you can make a match between this person and this organization. It's like any kind of shidduch or any kind of match that you're making, you're looking for, is there alignment here? Are there shared values? And so to that note, the last part of preparation is really, really being a product expert for your organization. What is it that you're doing? Who is served? Who benefits from your organization? What are some of the unique programs? So that you have a wide range of responses when you ask a donor a question about what they're interested in. How can you then make the match between this person and your organization? You have to really know your product and also be able to talk about your product through a variety of stories, not just rely on facts and figures. So I'll give you an example. I do a lot of work in the Jewish day school world here, and a lot of people think that Jewish day schools just benefit kids and parents who attend those day schools. But if that's your donor base, you're in trouble, because those parents are spending between $20,000 and $100,000 on tuition already. They're a very tapped out donor base. If you start looking at how your day school is a Jewish communal institution, how it's a leadership training institute for the next generation, how the day school kids go out to the community to do X, Y, and Z, now you've really widened, not only have a deeper understanding of your product, but you've widened the range of people that you can ask, because you're looking at your product through a more expansive lens.
Right. So, and I think that is, try to get them to associate with whatever you're doing is the trick of the whole thing. And I found that in going to organizations, sometimes they'll just give you money to go away. But oftentimes you'll get more if you can get them to understand what you're talking about, and also get that warm, fuzzy feeling of having put money into something which is close to their hearts and which they understand. Because sometimes it's too nebulous. It's right out there, and they're probably not going to see the end result. And so, you know, why would they just give it? You know, that I find is really the transition that you've got to try and convince people who are going out to talk to potential donors, to really, for them, as you said in the beginning, for them to really understand what they're selling.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yep.
Okay. Ray, we're going to take a quick break. We have to pay the bills, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
And we're talking to Ray Ringel from the Ringel Group in Washington, D.C. Must be pretty close to Trump. And I don't know if in thought or in presence.
Let's go there.
Okay, let's not go down that road. I found when I was in the United States a couple of times, I've been there quite often, and the phone keeps ringing. And generally speaking, the owners of the house don't answer the phone because they know it's people phoning for money. Is that going on at a pace, or is it slowing down?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's definitely slowing down. I receive a lot less telemarketing, maybe because I do the, you know, like a no call list or whatever it is, but I definitely feel like that is slowing down, at least in our parts. That and mail is slowing down. It seems to be a lot more social media based. Which is hard because it's fast and you get it to people and it's less expensive, but it's not as personal.
So I sit between two things because I actually hate getting the mail asking for stuff, but I'm a avid sender of mail to ask for money. So I fall in between the two. And, so my sympathies lie with some of these organizations, also with organizations that have call centers and phone you and want to, and the poor person on the other side struggling to get your buy-in. But we're talking now at a kind of a different level. And the difference between something like the Spire Foundation, which is almost, as Hedley says, like a business, And our organization, which is 99.9% volunteers working in different areas right around, and we have lodges in the United States, in Israel, in England, and in, of course, right throughout South Africa. And we're working within our communities and raising funds. And it's not easy because often you're going to the same people, and if you don't spread outside of the Jewish community, then you've got, as Hedley said in the beginning, a very limited audience that are going, or limited supply, whereas you need to do projects outside in order to attract outside money. And this is also difficult because we're continually breaking new ground. You have to get them to know what the organization is before you can even get a foot in the door. And they're so inundated with requests for money. How do you differentiate? How does one get that foot in the door?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that's where the relationships come in, is figuring out who is connected to that person who can actually open that door. I think getting the appointment with a donor is, I mean, that's just the hardest part about everything. If you really want to meet with someone face to face and connect with them in a personal way, getting people to meet with you is the hardest. First of all, everyone is so busy. When I call people to meet with me and they say, I'm sorry, I don't have the time. I want to say, do you think I have all day? I mean, I don't say that. I think that, you know, I work more than full time. I have 4 young kids. Like I get it.
4 young kids and a husband.
Right? So you have to, yes, and a husband.
And a master's degree.
Yeah. Right. So you have to honor where people are. So basically when I call people and they say to me, I'm too busy, my response is I just go like super relational. I pause and I say, honestly, nobody gets that more than me. Nobody. And then I just pause. And I'm so genuine. Literally nobody gets that more than me. And I just find that just really connecting and saying, and this is like 10 minutes. How do we make this work? Well, I know we can both make this work. And it tends to work. Or getting really creative about where to meet people. Maybe they're not going to be able to meet you for coffee for 2 hours, but maybe you're going to an event and you can pull them aside for a few moments. Like to be innovative about how you can actually end up meeting with people without agreeing to meet them on like, you know, a dark alley at 3 a.m. you want to honor your own time as well. But I think that, we have to be a bit more creative about how we're meeting with people. It's funny. I had a women's campaign tell me once about the parking lot solicitation or the parking lot campaign, which did not sound so good. It sounded a little sketchy to me. And what they said is that they found that these moms were congregating, like meeting with each other on Sunday mornings in the temple parking lot, waiting to pick up their kids from Hebrew school. And so they started calling their friends saying, hey, can you meet me 10 or 15 minutes early? I want to talk to you about something about the synagogue and what we're doing and your involvement. And people typically weren't that busy, you know, at that hour. And it was kind of brilliant because they were sort of standing on sacred Jewish space. And 20 minutes later, their kids came running out with, you know, fresh baked challah or their tzedakah box or whatever it is. There was actually in that space on that ground, and it was setting the context. So I don't think it has to be, I go to your office and your secretary lets me in and I pull up a chair. I think that choreography is long gone. We have to be really creative about the spaces we're meeting in and how we get in front of people.
Yes, I think that you've got to keep it short and sweet. I mean, and people don't have the time also to read long preparation, long prepared studies of things, and they want a one pager. You know, give me the facts and let's move on.
I think the other thing to remember is, in the ideal world, fundraising would not be done in the first meeting. You would be cultivating people over time. And, you know, in the university model, which they practice relationship-based fundraising, you have 6 to 12 touches to a donor a year. That could be a card, an email, a meeting, a coffee, a present, an event. Like, there's like 6 to 12 times where you're interacting with that donor. We just don't have, they also have a development office at universities of 150 people, right? Like, we might have 1.2 people in our operation. So in the ideal world, you're meeting with someone for the first time just to connect and to talk and not ask them for anything. There's a really important saying in fundraising that if you ask someone for money, you'll get advice. And if you ask someone for advice, you'll get money. So what I try and do is in my first meeting, can I just engage with someone and hear about who they are and get their advice and get them invested? And then perhaps maybe the second time I meet with them. My husband and I were invited recently by the head of our day school to talk about how to market our new middle school. We just built a middle school. And in the car on the way over, my husband says, she's definitely going to ask us for money. And I said, there is no way she is going to ask us for money. He said, she's definitely asking us. I said, almost, I taught this woman about fundraising. She knows that if she's going to ask us for money, she has to tell us. So we put a bet on the table about whether or not it's going to happen, which is not fun to bet with your husband because, you know, we have a joint checking account. And we went through the whole meeting and she's asking us our advice and how to position this and what's the message and who does it need to land for. And at the end, she said, thank you so much. This was such an incredible value to me and I'm going to use this immediately. And I almost was like, and? And I said, okay, thanks, let's go. And, you know, obviously I pulled him out of the office and obviously I won the bet. But it was brilliant because not only did she honor what the intention of the meeting was, you know I'm going to give to the middle school because now I'm an invested partner in thinking about, like, its success and I'm behind it and how are we going to sell it. So I know that time is such a precious commodity, but if we can invest some time in just really connecting with people and asking their advice and their opinion, I assure you that's going to lead to more gifts.
So, Ray, in our community, one of the Dermans of the fundraising world is a guy by the name of Herbie Rosenberg. And Herbie always says that it's not about fundraising, it's friend-raising. And it's about creating that connection, because once you've got a connection – you'll get whatever you need in the long term, but you've got to create that friendship and create a proper forward-thinking, ethical friendship. So it's a great point.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm sorry for that noise in the background. I agree with that. I just have one exception to that. And sorry, I don't know how to turn that off. So the one exception I have to that is this. Sometimes when we get too deeply invested in the friend raising, when we get too invested in the friend raising, it means that I'm going to give a gift because of my connection to Stan, right? Like, Stan's a great guy. He's really passionate. I believe in him as a leader, so I'm going to give this gift. And that's great for a first-time gift, but that's not great for a sustained gift year in and year out. So eventually the relationship has to transfer from Stan to the organization and the product. So often, I'll give you a perfect example. In New York, you can have a fundraising dinner where someone on Wall Street is honored, and you can raise $1 million that night for that school or that synagogue or that organization. But none of those people are ever going to give a second time, because they're giving because of the person who's being honored. And so I always say to people, that's a great model, but you're going to leave so much money on the table unless you convert that gift to giving to a person and then giving to the organization, where you now feel something for the organization. So I agree that the motivation is to go in friend-raising and not to forget that eventually we have to figure out a way to make a connection between the product and this person. Does that make sense?
Perfect sense.
Yeah.
And especially in areas where there's limited funds, or there's, you know, and there's so many places to give it that, yes, they're going to spread it around and your chances are probably one off.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. There's something else that I just want to make sure we get to. And that is for the Jewish world. And I think I've told you this before. I spend quite a bit of time in teaching fundraisers in the Jewish space, Jewish texts, and use it as inspiration and try and get them to see, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about the mitzvah of giving and how much do we give and, you know, what does the Rambam say about giving? Like, we spend so much time on giving, and I don't think we spend enough time in our, you know, looking into our tradition, exploring what does our tradition say about the role of the asker. And there are some wonderful texts that talk about the role of the asker. But the one I wanted to make sure to get out to you today, and I think you've read about this before, I've written about this, is really from the Shulchan Aruch, which says, if a person convinces another person to give, then the reward is greater than when they give on their own. Which means, you know, if I give a gift, terrific. And if I ask Andrew for a gift, I get two mitzvahs and Andrew gets one, right? Like I get double the reward. And I always say to people, why do I get double? Andrew was the one who gave. And, you know, ultimately what it's saying is that if I hadn't asked Andrew, he wouldn't have given. Whether he didn't know about it or he was involved in other things, I have enabled him to give this gift. And ultimately, I have given him the opportunity to perform the mitzvah of tzedakah. Right? I've given him the opportunity to perform this righteous act. So really the only thing that should happen when I'm asking Andrew for a gift is Andrew should stand up and thank me for asking. Now, I always joke around with students saying, that doesn't mean I walk into the room and say, Andrew, you need to thank me. I don't actually say it, but this is my state of mind. This is how I show up, that I'm making an offer as opposed to a request. An offer to be a part of something magnificent, an offer to feel good, an offer to change the world, an offer to help. And if I do it from that perspective, then I can show up from a spirit of strength and optimism as opposed to a spirit of apology. I'm so sorry, we have to have this conversation about money and I hope it's okay, and sort of making myself small. If I really see giving as giving an offer. And I think that, you know, when I'm teaching fundraising seminars, that is the single most important thing I want people to remember, that piece from the Shulchan Aruch. Because if you do not reframe the notion of what it means to ask someone for money and you can't see it as extending an invitation for someone to perform a righteous act, you are never going to do it, or you're never going to enjoy it while you're doing it. Like the inner game runs the outer game, and we really have to work on people's psychology and mindset before their technique and their skill. And that's really my bias when teaching this.
I think that's very relevant, because sometimes one would be sitting around maybe a Shabbos table or visiting friends, or have friends visit you. And the discussion goes around as to one particular organization, and somebody will knock that organization for whatever reason. And if you could stand up and really say why that organization deserves to be getting funds, you are doing that mitzvah, because I think that oftentimes people really, you know, have a grudge, or they want to say something derogatory about organizations for whatever reason they may have. And you may know better, and I think one should speak up and, you know, put them right, and in that way try and encourage them, say, well, you should give because X, Y, Z. And it's important that these organizations, because without the donors, and thank goodness for the generosity, in South Africa we have a particularly generous Jewish community, but we're, you know, outside of the community they're also particularly generous, and sometimes they get put off, not going to give because somebody says something bad. If you know better, you should speak up.
Right. Right. Yeah, I hear you. So I think that if we're going to really change the culture, get back to that place where people are feeling lucky and honored to ask, we have to dig into their inner world a bit. And tap into that feeling of, even, you know, I'm so lucky that I get to be the person to ask, that I get to actually be in this position. You know, it's funny. When people in Washington do these phone-a-thons for the Federation, I sometimes train the young folks to help them do it. I don't love it. I don't love phone campaigns at all, but sometimes just to kind of clean up the campaign at the end of the year, you have to do it. And I said to them, listen, just remember at the end of the day, not to apologize, because like the Talmud says, even the poorest person who makes all of their money from tzedakah, the only money they have is from receiving charity, they are required to give charity to the community. Why? Because they deserve the dignity of feeling good. Like they deserve the feeling that they can participate, that they are strengthened, that they can also participate. So I'll never forget when I was monitoring the calls, I was walking up and down the aisles. I heard these young adults on the phone. I heard one guy on the phone saying, oh, it sounds like, you've had a hard year. I'm so sorry. He said, but do you know that even the poorest person is required to give charity? And I thought, oh my God, that was not supposed to be a comeback. That was used for inspiration.
Right.
So I stopped using that in my training session, but it's an important point too, to think about. Not only are we not absolved from this, but we're trying to help people feel good and dignified and to feel part of something. And why should we apologize for that? Why can't we just feel so proud to extend that offer?
So Ray, I'm really pleased that I asked you to join us tonight and come on the show. And it's been an inspiration. And do you want to take a few moments just to give yourself, your organization, a punt of what you do? It's not only fundraising. I mean, it's more leadership for communities and organization and so on.
Sure. Thank you so much. I have an executive coaching and leadership training firm in Washington, D.C. And it is about executive coaching and leadership coaching. It's training and it's facilitation. So it's really about identifying for teams and individuals and organizations what's the intervention they need, and then we design the right intervention. Sometimes it's coaching, sometimes it's training, sometimes it's facilitation. A lot of times it's in some sort of communication breakdown. And then the second thing that I do is I founded and I direct an institute at Georgetown University that is an executive certificate in facilitation and design. And it's a 4-month program that really teaches people the art and craft of facilitation, whether you lead weekly meetings or design retreats or conferences or curriculums or programs or even conversations. It teaches people how to design these experiences, how to have presence and communication, how to deal with difficult participants, how to deal with a diverse workforce, different exercises, modalities. It's a very rich offering. It's really my baby and the thing I'm most proud of. So people come in from all over the world, and I have coaching clients all over the world. I have some very, very close and amazing colleagues who are in South Africa. So always happy to come and visit. And it's good. It's a big, full life. I have 4 small kids, and we are trying to raise them both in Israel and in Washington while working. It's a big, full life.
Wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
So Hedley says he's going to get the Smile Foundation to bring you out here.
I would love it. And let me tell you something. I could sit and listen to you guys talk all day. You could read the phone book. That accent is just the end of me.
And we think it's really not good.
It's great. I love it.
Ray, thank you so much. I'm going to engage a little bit with Hedley now. If you want to remain on, we have a few minutes remaining. Hedley, the Smile Foundation is running a project on the 23rd. And he's going to talk about that a little bit. And then I'm going to give some information about projects that we are busy doing. This hour is the Hebrew Order of David hour, the HRD hour. And we use it to reach out into the community and to show what we do, and also to get advice from people like yourselves, like yourself and Hedley, on how we should do things and what we can do better and how we should really conduct ourselves as Jews in the community. So Hedley, give us...
Thank you so much. First of all, Ray, thanks so much for sharing the airwaves. It's always a privilege to speak and share the airwaves with someone of your caliber. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
From Smile Foundation, just a 30-second introduction of who we are, where we've come from. We're a 19-year organization that helps children with cleft lip and palate and other facial reconstructive surgeries. It's done through supporting the National Department of Health and hospitals that really are the heroes of the country. We don't do the surgeries. So we don't do the skills development. What we do is we really that cog that brings things together to give the heroes the opportunity to do their thing and to step up and to change these children's lives. In doing so, we have various events, and the event that I just wanted to touch on, which Stan brought me in, and I really appreciate that, is the Toy Zone Kiddie Cycle Race, which takes place at Melrose Arch. And what it really is it's children raising money for children. So it's 500, 600 children that come in various age groups, step up and ride around a track. But there's a bigger meaning to it. It's about them riding around the track, but it's also about engaging in the future of other children. So as they're pedaling around the track, they're giving other children that opportunity. This event's happening on the 26th of May. It starts at 9, and there are various age groups appropriate to the specific child's needs and their age. And also, different age groups allow for different things. So firstly, the younger children are allowed to have their patient, their parents accompany them. The latter ones in the morning don't. And obviously it's because of speed, and the older ones obviously can do it themselves. And we're asking the community, we ask South Africa really to step up. Go to the Smile Foundation site, smilefoundation.co.za. It's 100 rand to enter, but it's 100 rand that can change a child's life. The other thing that I just want to say is that the goodie bag is truly cool. And that's why we're very excited when Toy Zone really steps up. The goodie bag is worth 350 rand on its own, and the kids really, really love it. So we look forward to having you all join us, and every 100 rand makes a difference. Many 100 rands can change children's lives. So stand to High FM, to an organization that really steps up like the HOD. It's really a privilege to sit across the table to say, well, it's not just about what the HOD, you've given me the airwaves to speak about another organization, and I think you haven't asked me for anything yet.
It's coming.
but what you have done is you're saying there are lots of good causes, there are lots of good opportunities, and today Smile Foundation, and on behalf of our executive chair, Mr. Lubner, and all of our board members, but most importantly on behalf of the children that are going to have the support, we really thank you.
Now, it's been an absolute pleasure. I just want to give you some other projects that are in the pipeline. So in the 1990s, South Africa won the World Cup rugby, and we're privileged to have Joel Stransky coming to talk at the HOD Center, which the Hebrew Order of David owns, a center in Orchards, Johannesburg. And we have a hall, and in that hall, Joel Stransky will come to talk. It starts at 8 o'clock. It's 80 rand per person. And the beneficiary is the Luma Hawk Foundation, Project Vision 2020. And we're testing eyesight of underprivileged children and supplying glasses through that foundation. And that is the pet project of Joel Stransky. We are also selling a book, which is called Learn Shabbos in Just 3 Minutes a Day. And, Ray, I'm going to try to get a copy to you. Although I'm sure you've quite steeped in all the nuances of Shabbos, but nevertheless I'll try and get a book to you. But it was written by a Rabbi Daniel Brody, now residing in Israel, and it's selling for 365 rand, delivered anywhere in South Africa, in 48 hours. We also have a project which we've launched nationally, which is called A Day in the Life of a Jew in South Africa. And today with technology, cell phones, you can take a picture at any time, any place, anything Jewish, send it to us at admin@hodavid.org. We hope to publish a coffee book and to raise money that way. We have 25,000 rand worth of prizes in the offing, and we're hoping to raise some more prizes, but that project will be launched within the next couple of weeks. Time is running out, and I'm going to thank you, Ray, for being on. Thank you, Hedley, for taking the trouble to come to the studio. Ray, I'd really like to invite you back over the next months to talk about other projects, other ways and advice that you can give for leaders, because quite frankly, I think there's a lot of people out there who could be leaders, need some advice, need some encouragement, and a person like yourself could be an inspiration.
I'd be happy to. Thank you so much.
And one day, possibly we'll bring you out here and or find a way to get you here to talk. And so it remains just to wish everybody a good Shabbos, and goodbye, and thank you from the Hebrew Order of David International.
God bless.
Thank you so much.